Sean. And back to you, Chris, sir. And I think you said there were as many as 8 people on Echo Link tonight. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
It's actually 15. We got up to 15 people on there, and no questions on Echo Link, but a lot of people. I want to thank everybody for participating and listening in. You know, if you can chime in with a question, that would be nice. So email one to me. I am listed on my email is listed on the QRZ. Go ahead and forward those questions to the net. Alrighty, everybody enjoy. Have a wonderful week. Talk to you soon. Dick, thank you and enjoy the week. KC2WGB. Good night, Wes.
Bye bye, you all. And as I said once before, try to be kind to each other. This is a hobby. This is something that you're doing for enjoyment. You're doing it to satisfy your curiosity. Don't take it too serious. And, if we use the hobby the right way, it's going to be extremely educational, and it doesn't hurt anybody. Bye-bye, you all. Enjoy it. Keep your eyes up and clear.
Thank you very much.
What happened?
Eric, let us know. What'd you find?
Oh, I used a spectrum analyzer to get me in the ballpark. Once I got in the ballpark, things started to work out right.
That sounds like success to me. Oh, I think you ordered a portion. You just earned a portion of that box of cigars, Eric.
Yeah, once I got in the resonance, I got rid of that negative going voltage. Then I could actually run the screen card up and make it do what it's supposed to do.
You put the new tube in also, Eric?
Say again?
Did you replace the tube with the new one?
Not yet. I still have some control issues to deal with, but at least I got past that big hurdle. That slowed me down for about 6 hours. Well, I'm probably going to call a manufacturer tomorrow and ask him a few questions.
So in other words, using the spectrum analyzer, if I understand you correctly, allowed you to walk in the right direction. You eventually found out which direction is uphill. You moved in the direction of resonance. And suddenly you found this mysterious resonance and started getting power output. Is that approximately what happened, Eric?
Yeah. The gentleman that kept saying it should be the top of on the screen is dead. Besides, the screen won't take 1,000 volts anyway. Once I started getting right near the ball, then I started to have to wait for the plate cut.
You may be going through a dropout area, Eric. There were a lot of dropouts on that last transmission. But I do sense that as you started finding resonance, as you put voltage on the screen, everything started coming back together, and that transmitter started working. Interesting question to ask, how did it get tuned that far out of resonance in the first place? I'm guessing some form of damage occurred at the lightning strike, and somebody started twisting the knob. I got a pretty far out of range. Is that approximately what happened? K2LIW?
It's not maybe. I'm still in the dirt. I'm heading to the Georgia Bridge. Because the thing is, the cavity, and actually what it is the altitude is actually the zero pulse of the. It's a coaxial cavity with a set of the in the center of it. The point line is a tube, which is a soap tube, and in the center of that plate line at DC ground, it is another little smaller tube with flows on the end. You follow?
50% of that was all dropout. The dropout's occurring every half second, but it's not pure picket fencing. Some of it is picket fencing dropout. Some of it may be over audio in this particular case. Try backing off on your audio and repeat that message. KE2EJ Mobile, K2LIW.
All right, LIW, KE2EJ. Do you copy me?
That transmission was beautiful. I hope it stays that way. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'm calling in between. Man, I'm there. The actual. The output tensor to this thing is a coaxial cap, whereas the plate line is a tube that sits over the tube. It is another tube with a set of flows in the end.
That transmission, you were only there 10% of the time, Eric. Only 10% of the time. But I do sense that there's an output cavity tuning to make sure all the harmonics are controlled. The tube itself, if I'm getting the impression correctly, is the quarter wave resonator. That's the input coupling network, so to speak. And so everything is deployed correctly as far as coupling between the tube as a resonator and the output cavity as a filter. The coupling coefficients and tuning have to be right in order for real signal to pour into the antenna. That's what I think you're saying. KE2EJ mobile, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Not exactly. It's like and a tube with the highest top. That's one part. Which has bellows at the bellows up.
I heard not exactly. I heard one part, and I heard bellows. I'm trying to put that all together. I'm presuming the bellows are part of a tuning mechanism, and things have to be within range before you start getting close to resonance and start coupling real power output. Here's my guess. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, I'm getting closer. I don't know if you can hear me. I mean, once I come down to the other side, I'll this round the two. The pipeline, which has a high voltage on it, is a pickup loop, and you change its angle, and that's the plate loading.
Okay. I heard the end. I heard the beginning. You're getting closer. I heard the end. The output coupling loop, as you change its orientation, that changes the loading. And I'm not as in favor with those kind of link coupling networks, but the link itself, whether or not it resonates, whether or not it's properly oriented towards the thing that it's picking up the signal from that resonates, and whether or not the thing resonates, all that's got to be right. And yeah, that orientation of that link coupler, how close it is it in line, out of line in its orientation, that can make huge differences in the tuning. So I can see how if anybody disturbed these controls for the time the transmitter was last operating, until the time it got into your hands, it could be so far out that without the spectrum analyzer, finding the tuning procedure, I think, could have been quite difficult. And without the spectrum analyzer, we'd have to worry about whether or not you'd live long enough to do it. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, K2RIW, KE2EJ. You should be able to hear me now.
That was a 98% transmission for the first time, go ahead.
Alright, I'm on the George Washington Bridge, so I'm getting closer. When you actually replace the tube, you're actually removing, you're moving the whole tank network. It's like a piece of coax, where the outer tube, which fits onto the tube itself, onto the plate of the tube, inside that, at DC ground, is another tube with a set of bellows on the end of it, which gets longer and shorter. That's the output coupling, or the output tuning. Outside, the outer tube, which is around the plate, is a loop, which you change the angle at which it couples, and that's the plate loading. And just by removing that assembly and moving it, so you can put the tube in there, you change the tuning.
For the first time, that was 100% transmission. Beautiful. So, the tube that got struck with lightning, maybe that was an event that caused the filament to fail, but for whatever reason, filament has failed on that tube, has to be replaced. The process of getting the tube out of this very interwoven network changes everything. And so once the new tube is in there, finding all these correct tuning procedures again is what you were involved in, and you're doing this at a remote site, and thank goodness you did have access to a spectrum analyzer, but you found out when you're walking in the right direction. It sounds like you got them back on the air. Well done. K2EJ, mobile, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, I don't leave it on the air because this guy still has some control problems. I don't happen to have a chip that I need, but that'll happen tomorrow. But I did want to get the tube lit. I left the old tube in there that I'm working with, the soft tube. Now that I have a good feel for it, because I never actually worked on this particular transmitter, this is my first time on it, I got a better sense of it. But now I'm going to give the manufacturer a call tomorrow and ask them a few questions, so maybe I'll have a better procedure in the end. K2RIW, K2J.
Yeah, quite often a test procedure is written by an outside source, and the person writing the test procedure only partially understands what he's writing about. So even though you were following a recommended test procedure, it might not have been written by the engineer who designed the original thing. So therefore, some of the information was missing. And I think they sent you down a blind alley, my guess, as to what was going on here, Eric. Sounds like you're making progress, and they're getting close to the point of having 100% power output with a helper tube. They're a couple of steps closer tonight, Eric. Back to you, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2K. Now I'm on the home of the drive. Now, the thing was designed in 1984, so it's a bit old, but, I'm sure they have a lot of experience out there with them. It's just kind of weird. It just struck me very strange that it operates like that, so. I mean, I wasn't sure whether all the stuff around the tube was right. I mean, I replaced about a half a dozen chips. So, although those transmitters usually don't get faulted by that thing, but I guess it must have been a real close one. So, anyway, the antennas are just intact because it's running on a standby transmitter, and this wire is just fine and dandy. K2RIW, K2J.
I'm going to make a guess that the lightning bolt destroyed a number of integrated circuit chips, but maybe that was or was not related to the tube also having a filament failure. I'm having trouble believing that the lightning bolt directly damaged the tube. Although maybe the tube could take the lightning bolt, maybe the filament could not. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
No, that's a possibility. Although this transmitter had a bunch of serious problems since the last, about a half a year ago. They kept banging it on and off, and on and off, and on and off. And, they would constantly go in protection, and they would just bang it back on again. So, the tube probably didn't fare too well through all of that stuff. And it actually turned out, which is something that I fixed about 4 months ago, was that the IPA would go into this overheat mode, and just all of a sudden the drive would go away, and it would stay on the air for like 20 minutes and shut itself off. So, I don't really know whether that affected the tube's life or not, but I've just never seen those tubes open up on the filament. That's a new one on me.
I agree with you. What does ITA stand for, Eric?
Intermediate power amplifier. Because most broadcast transmitters, you have an exciter. Exciter puts out maybe 7 watts or 10 watts or 20 watts. You use that, you go into another amplifier, get you some gain, get you up to 150, 200 watts, and then you feed the grid in a tube.
So I should have realized that it was India Papa Alpha. I thought I was hearing India Tango Alpha, and I couldn't make sense out of it. I also don't work in broadcast as much, so I don't recognize all the acronyms. And I think you guys got acronyms. Oh boy, some of the jobs I've worked on, the manual starts off with the acronyms on the first three pages worth of acronyms that are going to be used downrange. And some of the engineers get so angry, they write memos to the chain of command where the whole memo consists of nothing but acronyms with a couple of if ands and buts in there. That teaches them a lesson. Okay, I'm going to go away. Sounds like you've had a good night, Eric. Out in the field at crazy hours, fixing transmitters. This broadcast industry, those must be very dedicated people, Eric. K-E-Q-E-J, K-J-R-I-W.
Oh, as they say, time is money. And, well, it's really a public radio station, so. Not NPR, but, you know, it's in the educational band. So.
The one thing I want to know, though, Eric, is that the transmitter was continuously going into a protect mode, and they were banging it back on. Of the parameters, the protect circuitry was measuring. You know which one was going out of range? I'd like to know there's some way of finding out the history of those interrupts. Which one of the parameters for safety was going out of range in which direction? Was the screen current too high positive, too high negative, and so on? Over to you, Eric. KQRIW.
Well, what's actually happening is basically the tube was being turned back on without the filament being hot enough. That's one problem. They had set the timer to zero rather, you know, because some tubes will allow you to do a quick turn on. You need 10 seconds or 15 seconds. This was set to 0 seconds. And what was happening was the driver amplifier, the IPA, was going into an overheat mode. It was oscillating and then shutting down.
Yep. It didn't like looking into the open circuit of a final amplifier where the filament wasn't yet operational. Therefore, the tube was an open circuit. An open circuit is a high vis alarm. Therefore, it goes into a protect mode. And whoever chose to set the timer at zero, he thought he's doing something convenient for him. He's creating a problem downrange, wasn't he?
Yeah, and the same guy that did that didn't bother to tighten up the tube has fingers on it, you know, split fingers, and there's a clamp around it. And he didn't really clamp it to the tube very tight. You could just slide the thing off. You could see the marks on the tube where it actually made contact on two or three fingers instead of the whole thing.
I've seen that happen on high-power tubes where the fingers get welded to the tube because two fingers are making contact and all the current of resonance gets concentrated on those fingers. Did you see action? Did you see welding action going on there, Eric? Go ahead.
No, I've never seen that actually happen on an IMAX tube. I've seen that happen on some of the Russian tubes, but not in this particular case. Although, you can see that where it made contact, the tube nice and clean everywhere else is black and icky, you know. And they don't silverplate the outside of those tubes, but, it's, you know, it's a nice-looking metal, but when it turns dark and ugly, you know something bad's happening.
Do you believe enough air was always flowing through that tube to keep it at a reasonable temperature? Go ahead.
No, it's a thermal sensor there, so, you know, if your blower drops dead, there's also an interlock on the blower, so, you know, if you lose it, it shuts down. But, you know, the broadcast manufacturers are pretty smart about that stuff.
When that transmitter is cranking correctly, does it put out around 3,000 watts?
Fully loaded and tuned up properly, it puts out 3.5 kilowatts.
That's a nice number. When it comes to that kind of a station, I'm guessing it's an FM station, around 88 or 89 megahertz, 3,000 watts gives you what? Medium-sized local coverage. Sure, go ahead.
It's kind of... It's in a weird place. It's in West Orange, so... When the good transmitter is running, I could just start to pick it up at the Queens line. But then again, it's only a single... It's a... we can talk about this one. I sent you a link to the antenna manufacturer. You'll see that they list the antenna as minus 3 dB. We've had this conversation before. So, you know, the ERP is around 2 kilowatts. So 1900 watts is where it is, where it's at. And, oh, I'm sorry, yeah. So, you use the big power to make up the loss? Nah, I'm not going to get into that now. It's weird. I've never seen an antenna that was, listed as minus 3 dB of gain.
I wonder if the antenna includes the loss of the feed line when they talk about minus 3. If I'm pumping 3,500 watts into an antenna, and if it has negative gain, the only way an antenna can be below isotropic in gain is it's got resistive loss. To have negative gain, you have to be dissipating, let me pick a number, 1,000, 1,500 watts of I squared R power. Something must be getting hot. So the numbers seem a little strange. Over to you, Eric, T2LAW.
Because the circular polarized FM, they say it's minus 3 vertical, minus 3 horizontal for a single deck.
Oh, that makes more sense. You got it, Eric.
There you go. Actually, you need two of them to get unity gain. No. Now, this is only a single bay. It's not a dual bay, like, or a quad bay, like a lot of other bases are. Because you have to live with a co-channel in Connecticut, and there's another co-channel further west of them. So, you know, their pattern is kind of small compared to, you know, something that's on Empire.
The antenna is how many feet above the ground? And is it fed with a fairly nice piece of transmission line, air-filled transmission line? Go ahead.
Yeah, the transmission line is 3-inch heliac. You know, that big stuff. I showed you that stuff. I had that stuff at my place at 21. I used that as a, when we were making the transition from analog to digital, that's what I used to get into a temporary mass filter that, I mean, I eventually replaced it all with hard lines. So, or what I call hard line, EIA type cable. Cable, pipe, copper pipe.
Yeah, those are beautiful. 3-inch diameter Andrew Heliacs. Does that sell for $15 a foot, Eric?
I think it's a little more than that. But anyway, what did I get? I got, like 18 feet of it with, like, $900.
A little bit pricey. This antenna that you just worked on, of that transmitter, how many feet above the ground is that?
You know, if I wasn't driving, I would be able to tell you exactly. I can look it up on the FCC website. But, it's on the top of a mountain. Actually, it's got... There's a couple of TV transmitters up there. A bunch of radio stations. The tower itself is probably only about 150 feet.
Is the tower pretty beefy, pretty much like yours in Plainview?
No, it's pretty, you know, self-supporting. A lot smaller than what I am.
A lot smaller in altitude, but probably a much bigger base if it's self-supporting. Is it something like a Roan SSV?
No, it's bigger than a Roan 55, so I don't know what the next size up is.
Okay, the next size up is Roan 65 and then Roan 85. I own some Roan 85, a couple hundred feet of it, 43 inches on a side. And each vertical pipe is 2.5-inch diameter, schedule 40 steel, I think it is, galvanized, 750 pounds per section. Fairly sturdy stuff, stackable to 800 feet, with skywires. Now, said self-supporting, so I'm a little bit confused here. Is it a constant cross-section tower all the way up except for the zero-moment base? And are you saying it's got no guy wires? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's got no guy wires. It's not made out of tubes. It's made out of flat, you know, angle on it. It's not as big as Elliott's tower. The structure itself, the material, I guess, you know, it's got the edges in it as you go up, but
It's this big, heavy, flat stuff. I mean, I'd call it anilining, but it's not the stuff that you use to build the skyscrapers with. But it's something of that nature. I think it's bigger than that, the tower that you have, in terms of its width or its diameter. Okay, so it's a pretty wide tower, and constant all the way up, and no guy wires, and roughly 150 feet. And probably at least one of its three legs has got post spikes sticking out of it that are made for climbing for the rigger, is that true? It's a rectangle. It's not three-legged, it's four-legged. Okay. But it probably doesn't own an elevator. It's probably got spikes sticking out of one of the four legs for the rigger to climb, is that true? Nope.
I didn't actually see any, but then again, I didn't look that closely at it, so next time I look, I'll let you know.
If it's got no spikes for climbing sticking out of a leg, that implies that ball service takes place by way of a crane. Go ahead.
Could very well be. Well, it's actually the smallest tower in the flop. There's about six or seven towers at that site. And then across the road where the mountain gets a little bit higher, there's more stuff. So it's sort of communication central. But I don't know, I think the elevation is like, 1,500 feet or something like that.
And I think you said West Orange, New Jersey. I should know, but I don't. Roughly how many miles is that from the GW?
Not that far. Maybe about 8, no, it's more than that. Maybe it's about 25 miles, something like that.
So this is nowhere near Alpine or nowhere near the Palisades. This is somewhere inland with the local mountain in New Jersey.
Yeah, well, if you were to go through the Holland Tunnel and go through Jersey City, it's, if you travel a turnpike, you've seen 280. It's almost at the end of 280.
Okay, that helps me locate it. And so you've been keeping them on the air for a while. How many of these places do you go to in New Jersey, Eric?
Actually, we've been doing a lot of... They've got a grant to do, from the MECA organization, where if you're doing any kind of media stuff, they will fund you. So we built them a TV studio with really cheap canvas, a really nice little switcher, and a bunch of stuff to do streaming. I mean, we've been doing some experiments with... I have a device, which is made by a company called Teledex, which essentially uses four cell phone modems, five cell phone modems, you mount that on top of your camera, and then there's software at the other end that puts it all back together. You're basically using the cell phone to transmit high-definition video that's not compressed too much.
You know, I'm getting the impression by the fact that now you can buy remotely piloted drone-like devices that you talk to it with your cell phone or your laptop. What you're describing, I think these cell phones are going to catch on, Eric. And it's amazing to me that there's about 4.5 billion of them in use worldwide right now. In the country of Saudi Arabia, the number of cell phones in use is twice as big as the population. That implies that each human being in Saudi Arabia has, on average, more than two cell phones. I presume one is used for business and one is used for private communication. But all of that handheld, two-way, wireless communication called cell phone-like device, 4.5 billion of them in the world, 3.999 billion of those people don't know the name of the ham radio operator that invented that concept. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
K2LAW, K2EJ. Well, it's probably 3.9997 billion that don't know it. But, the fun part about doing the video over the cell phone is we were in Union Square in the city, and we were getting really, really good results. And then, all of a sudden, all these people come out of the subway, and that was it. We couldn't couldn't keep the connectivity because the cell sites, and there's many of them in that location, just got completely overloaded in a fraction of a moment.
What kind of data rates were you expecting to transmit to that system, Eric?
Now, with the five modems, what we did was we had two on AT&T, two on Verizon, and another one on T-Mobile. When things were working well, I was getting a throughput about 4.5-5 megabits with no problem.
Now, they all have different latency periods. You must have some pretty fancy software that can take those various variable latencies and put it all back together. I'm guessing all of your packets have got some very nice timing codes telling the system how to put it all back together. Go ahead.
Yeah, actually it does. What they do is they put PIDs on each packet, which identifies them. But the latency of the system overall is about, the best that we got was something like 35 seconds. So on the average it would be like, not quite a minute, but almost up there. And then of course the software is putting it all back together at the other end.
Who wrote that software, Eric?
A company called Teledec. T-E-L-E-D-E-K. They also make a bunch of other interesting stuff. They make 5 gigahertz transmission system for short hop, where you can stick a receiver somewhere and you put the transmitter on top of the camera and, you can pretty much walk around within, 1,000 feet and maintain good connectivity.
In order to create all of these cell sites, micro cell sites, mini cell sites, and whatever, to create all of this connectivity, all of this data rate, and all of these locations, there's a lot of highly competitive build-out going on right now. By way of one of the PBS specials that you know about, do you know what the true cost of that build-out really is? Go ahead.
Of what, cell sites?
Roger, Dodger. To build out all of those cell sites, what do you think is the most expensive item that's going into that? I'll warn you, this is a left-handed question. Now, go ahead.
Now, assuming that they're building their own towers, that's probably the most expensive part. But again, you know, there's connectivity issues. They all take T1 lines, T1 from the phone company. The radios themselves, I think, is probably the least expensive part of the whole domain.
Yeah, I told you this is left-handed. By way of the PBS special and other data that was published in the last couple of weeks, I seem to remember the number is 25 Americans are dying per year doing that build-out because of improper training. I mean, the way the subcontracts, multiple subcontracts go on between the real company that needs the build-out and the final contractor that really does the work, and he's doing it at minimum dollar with minimum prepared people. Something like 25 tower workers per year are dying. And when it comes to high steel construction industry, the cell site industry is killing people 10 times faster than any other high steel construction function. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
K2LAW, KE2EJ. You're talking about the front line program that was actually with last September. Actually, since that program has happened, a number of the cell companies have vowed that they would pay more attention and get properly trained individuals, knock off some of the subcontractors,
yeah.
They can say whatever they want. What they do is something else.
That's exactly what I was going to say. They say those words, I'd be amazed if 5% of them are really doing it, Eric. Go ahead.
I can tell you that T-Mobile and Sprint are actually doing it. I don't know about the other guys, because we've got the T-Mobile site at our place. When they built it, it was... It got me very mad because they promised they would do a bunch of things and they didn't. But anyway, they pay us a lot of money to occupy the tower space. But when they did it, they had some real idiots doing it. But lately now, the crews that have been coming actually well seasoned and well trained, so I don't feel so bad about it.
When you watch those riggers doing the work, what percentage of the time are they doing free climbing?
Free climbing as in without belt or with belt?
During the time they're transitioning from the base of the tower to the place in the tower where they're going to do work, are they fall or rest protected during that climb? If not, that's called free climbing. Over to you, Eric, K2LAW.
Yeah, I've got two lead lines on their tower, which have the safety clamps where you can pull them up, but you can't pull them down, and they're hooked up to it. Whereas the first crew that came didn't do that, and we made them leave.
Yeah, I think that's called Ron Lock, Ron antenna, Ron Lock. And that's a very nice safety feature. In other words, the first crew that you had said, I don't need that. And I've never done it that way. Why should I do it that way now? I don't want to spend the time. And you got rid of the smart move because they could be eating into your liability insurance policy pretty fast, Eric. Go ahead.
Well, we don't let anybody climb that doesn't have the appropriate insurance. It's a minimum $3 million policy. So we've had companies come by that can't produce the paperwork, and we tell them to go somewhere else. But although I've been up there, and I'm not supposed to be, but, you know, I got my own gear, so. How do you think my repeater antennas got there?
I understand. And do they use the word bonded? Are any of these riggers so-called bonded as well as a 3 megabuck insured? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, bonded and insured.
Yes.
The folks at the company have changed and become more dot the I's and cross the T kind of people, and we had to tell some folks that we really like to use that, you know, this stuff wasn't adequate and just can't do it.
Yeah, there was somebody else who made a comment. Who was that?
KTPS, I just got a question for Eric.
You got it, sir, John. Oh, Rich.
Eric, what was the traffic like on the GW Bridge? I know they've been doing that construction project that was supposed to be shut down 3 lanes, and I need to know if I'm going to go that way or if I should go down to Staten Island. I won't be hitting it for about another 3 hours.
KTPS, K2J. No, they're not doing any work tonight, so. It took me the time that it took to slow down and go through the toll gate, and I wound up on the Home River Drive in like a minute or two. Wasn't that long. So there's no delays here, so if you want to take the Detroit, be my guest.
Juliet India Whiskey. Excellent information. I appreciate that. And yeah, I didn't think they were doing it on the weekends, but I wasn't 100% sure. All I know is that they said it's going to take 12 weeks, and it might only be Monday through Friday night that they're doing it, but they're shutting down 3 lanes in both directions when they do it overnight. And it's a mess during the week, but I wasn't sure what it was like on the weekend. So, but I appreciate it. I'm just coming into Carlisle, Pennsylvania now.
And you look like you're fairly close to Harrisburg. I think we're hearing Jim in the background. Victor Echo 3, Juliet India Whiskey. Go right ahead, Jim. K2RIW. Non-technet.
Well, good morning. I've been listening for a while. And at the beginning of the net, and even 9 o'clock, the streaming audio was down, but I'm on radio. When you mention bonding, if a company's bonded, you might want to check something. I think that the bond is only payable to the employer. You'd have to successfully collect from the employer for the bond company to pay you. I don't think bond coverage allows you to approach the bonding company. It's only my opinion, and laws are different between Canada and the United States, but I think there's a misconception of what bonded means. But I'm listening along because tower safety is an issue, and we have a regulation by Ontario Working with heights that requires special training about harnesses and lanyards, and working with heights that isn't just for tower but any construction. But WGB, I think, KQRAW, thank you for letting me in, and I'm joining along, but I'd be interested in your comments on bonded people.
Yeah, I think that's directed to you, Eric. KE2EJ, KQRAW.
KQRAW, KE2EJ. You know, I'm not really up on the law of what it means. All I know is that, you know, the lawyers look over the stuff and they say, yes, no, yes, no. And they require them to be bonded now. I wasn't driving. I could look it up and tell you exactly what it means, but I'm not sure, so I'm not going to give you an answer. I have an idea, but I really don't know if that's right, so.
Authentic.
You got it, John.
Dick, normally how it works, you have the insurance certificates for the men. Okay, that covers that. The bonding is usually a completion bond, which is floated for the price of the project. If you do not complete the bond and they have to bring somebody else in, the bonding company will drop that client, never insure them again, and pass the bond money on to the next company that does the completion work.
Okay, that seems to make some sense. Does that seem to hang true with what you heard, Eric? Say again, Dick? With what John just said, does that seem to run true with what you have experienced?
Yeah, that sounds about right. I mean, it's sort of the idea that I had, but I think it's a little more involved than that. There's also, it covers a certain liability. I don't know what the rules are exactly about it, but I do know that somebody that's a complete job, usually, it's just what John says, they lose the insurance that is provided to them. So, but you know, that's an interesting question. I think when I go back to work on Tuesday, I'll ask the lawyer. Very good. Rich, I've got a question for you. When I looked up UPS CACH, and you know why I looked that up, catch, I also found something called the Mike Boyd UPS Collection. And I eventually got down to this beautiful picture of what the instrument panel on one of your vehicles looks like. And unfortunately, there's not quite enough resolution on this color picture for me to really read each of the gauges. But I'm seeing a whole lot of what looks like temperature gauges. I'm wondering if your instrument panel gives you an exhaust gas temperature on each one of the cylinders of that diesel engine. Is that what I'm looking at on that instrument panel? K2 Uncle Papa Sierra Mobile, K2RAW. He might be in between cells, right?
Okay, I'll wait a little while and repeat. And let's see now. If he is between web cell sites, then I wouldn't be getting an update on his location. His location was last updated, let's see, oh yeah, more than a minute ago. He was very likely in between cell sites.
Very well be. Well, you know, I mean, he's got good cell coverage, but sometimes it's, well, some of the cell sites don't have LTE and 4G, or even 3G. They wind up doing edge. But, no, I'm sure he'll show up again.
Yeah, I can tell when he's going to show up because I'll get an update on his location on the APRS that's tracking him right now.
About the course 81, right, Dick?
APRS is not cell site. APRS is 2 meters.
Yeah, he's got a cell site-like application that's giving him an APRS-like function with his application plus the website that he sent me to. It's APRS-like, but it's really done by way of cell communication. And he's now up to 2 solid minutes since it's upgraded. It normally upgrades every 15 seconds or so. So he is between cell sites. He's en route to 70 right now, approaching Harrisburg. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2IW.
Yeah, Dick, I agree. He's going to cross 81. He might even be across 81 already in 2 minutes of Martindale. So we should be hearing from him shortly.
I guess you're speculating that 81 has better cell-site coverage, and he's now over 2 minutes since an update.
Yeah, well, obviously he's not hearing it, so I didn't come back. Well, I'm not making bad time here. Well, I've been putting miles on the car, that's for sure.
Thank you for visiting.
Then, because I was going to put the digital repeater up at Split Oaks this weekend, and that didn't happen. Because we're actually moving another studio for another place. Trying to get that done. I don't know, all of a sudden I found myself busier than I can imagine, so. But I'll tell you, it's going to help pay the bills. Keep the RWK through, Jack. I see out of what's going on. The last update, he was moving 4 miles an hour. I think he's at a depot outside of Harrisburg. You know, the big truck stop in Carlisle, Carlisle. I don't know how you pronounce it. And then, you know, you wind up hitting 81 right after that. You're absolutely right. I'm looking at that truck stop we've got right now. So I'm guessing that was a pit stop or a refuel. I'm going to guess it's a pit stop. Yeah. Well, Texas. And always truck has a lot of amenities in it. I don't know if it has facilities in it. Although it might. Although I kind of doubt it. Now, I forget the reason that they go to these truck stops. It's not to get refuel. It's at a highway truck stop right now, I think. Yeah, well, the refuel is one thing, to eliminate is another.
Agreed. They do almost all of the refueling right at the UPS locations at each end. That way they know exactly what kind of fuel they're getting. I think that's part of it.
Yeah, I remember him telling me that his tanks are big enough to get from one place to the other without having to stop.
Yeah, he told me on his last discussion on the subject that if he was willing to really stretch it, he could make the complete round trip on one refueling. But it would be getting dangerously near empty at the end. He'd worry about climbing a hill and starting out the pickup tube in the truck and in the tank.
It's the business. It's my business. Anyway, what's he traveling? 700-800 miles each way, each day?
I think he said he puts on 5,000 miles a week. I vaguely remember those numbers. When it comes to the pickup tube being starved out on the tank, that's exactly what happened during the Avianca air crash. Where were you during that incident, Eric? K2RIW?
The one where it went off the south side of Long Island?
No. This is the one that crashed in Oyster Bay Cove because the aircraft from Barranquilla ran out of fuel because it had been put into so many delay patterns on the way up the coast. Go ahead.
No, I don't remember that one. I have a vague recollection of it. I don't know when it was, so I couldn't tell you where I was.
I'm a little shy on memory right now, but if I had to make a guess, around 1990 or so is when that occurred.
I don't know. We'll have to think about that. I know about the one where they claimed the empty tank in the fuselage did the explosion. W2 NDR and a bunch of other people were on site helping out.
Okay, I found it. Avianca air crash, January 25, 1990. Oyster Bay Cove, Cove Neck, New York, fuel exhaustion, 158 passengers and crew became fatalities. No, 85 fatalities. 85 fatalities. But a huge communication problem because in Oyster Bay Cove, Cove Neck, there was no cell coverage. The town will not allow you to put a cell site in there. So, boy, did they have problems. How about you, Eric?
What, in 1990 they were
moaning about it. I thought it was later than that.
Nope. Avianca air crash, January 25, 1990.
Oh, I'm talking about cell coverage up there.
There is and was no cell coverage up there. In Oyster Bay town itself, there used to be one single cell site, but the local politicos would not allow anybody go in there to update it, to repair it or whatever, and it died. There are no cell sites in the town of Oyster Bay.
Yeah, but something reminds me that it was later than 1990 that that business started happening.
No, it started earlier than that. Earlier than that, they would not allow cell sites. Later than that, they're not allowing any cell sites. There are no cell sites there. You go into that town, if you get cell coverage at all, you're being picked up by Connecticut in many cases.
Oh, okay. Because I know about Bayville and that part, making it worse. You know, Oyster Bay itself, which is cell site, Norwood is a cell site, all of that.
Bayville does have a cell site on their water tower. And for the last 4 years, essentially all those relatives are fighting very hard to get rid of it. And they haven't succeeded yet. But Oyster Bay never allowed any cell sites in the first place. Somehow one got stuck in there, and they made sure it died.
Yeah, good for them. Maybe they can put payphones on the street.
And I think the attitude of the residents was that all of these people died because emergency services couldn't get to these people during this 1990 January crash. And I think their attitude is, yeah, the cell sites more than would have survived. But those are people outside of our area. They shouldn't have been here in the first place.
Well, what can I tell you? Besides, you go up into Oyster Bay Cove Nest, you have to go through the gate before you can get there. And you don't look where you ain't going.
I understand. You're saying it's a little bit restrictive. Say that again? It sounds like it's a little bit restrictive. If I was living there and wanted to put up my tower, do you think I'd get any flack?
I think you'd get sued.
That sounds like flack to me.
Well, I'm not sure you'd want to live with those kind of snotty people.
They don't sound like serious ham radio operators, do they?
No, it sounds like human beings that really are not very thoughtful. I have other words, but I'm not going to say it.
I got a vague idea what you're thinking.
We can get into the discussion about the world of politics and all that stuff. Yeah, I'm not going to do that.
They are controlling their territory. It's all my property.
If I wasn't so close to home, we started on this. That would give me an earful, but I'm not going to do it now.
Roger, Dodger.
Anyway, I think it's just a gas in my property and stuff. Back in 2 minutes, if you're still there, I'll talk to you. If not, then have a good night, Dick. It's RIWK2K.
Roger, I may have to go away. It looks to me like, AB is leaving the west. AB is leaving the truck stop at this time.
I blew up that image of that map. There's a wind there, and they stopped to pick up something also.
That sounds right. So the pit stop might be for food.
Could be. I think it's moving right now less than 2 miles an hour. So, but I don't see the vehicle going anywhere.
Yep. 2 miles an hour and more than 1 minute. It's an update.
You know, by the way, it's, that site that you're using, is APRS Lite or APRS FI?
APRS FI. You got it.
No, you can put my call sign in there. It's UI.
Would the system track two people simultaneously? I'm a little worried that it'll just get all mixed up.
Oh, it'll track a whole bunch of people. I think you do more than one, but you have to switch between. I know that's multiple, but you have to be in the same area, that's it.
Okay. Are you in the area of Harrisburg right now?
I think not.
By the way, if I put in your call letters, what's the dash number after it?
Say again?
If I put in your call letters, I have to have a dash number after. What's your dash number after the call letters?
Well, I'm one of the few people that follow the rules. Mine is dash 9, which is mobile.
A lot of people just make up the numbers and they don't follow the, they don't follow Bob's layout.
Now, it turns out the Rich is Dash 14, which is a tractor trailer truck.
And that was after, well, we've had conversations about that. Yeah, there's a list of what the dash number is supposed to be, as opposed to a packet which has three different, different allocations of these numbers.
So what do you think APRS.fi would do if I put in your call letters simultaneously and in two very different areas? Go ahead. What would it try to do?
You know, if you try it, you'll find out. I don't really know. But usually when I go to that site, I'm looking for someone in particular.
And sometimes I'm a little afraid to try these things because some of these crazy programs, you make a request, it goes into a hang-up mode, and sometimes there's no good way to back out.
Now, you're anti-computer, what can I tell you? So what you could do is you could open up, this is a simple solution. You're using a Linux machine, so you could tab out another browser page and go to APRS on two pages. Put one call sign on one page, another call sign on another page.
If I was a computer person, I would have thought of that. I've only got 10 pages open right now. Okay. That's a good suggestion. Thank you. I may have to go away.
No, I'm pumping gas, though. Talk to you next week. Oh, don't die next week. How about that? You're trying to be good today. And I'll be back in a minute, John. Don't go anywhere.
Okay, Eric. John, I appreciate it.
Hey, Wes, what's up? Did you get your thing down into the basement?
I'm going to be working on it tomorrow. And then let me sit on the phone. How am I coming down?
Perfect. Sounds good.
This place is closed. I'm going to go to another place.
Okay. Then you want to go to another place?
Well, Eric's got the repeater on, so we can use it, no problem.
Oh, Eric, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
No, I'm back. Yeah. They're doing a ship change at this gas station. I'm going to go to the other one. By the way, Dick, if you look, you can see where I am. Hello, Wesley. How are you?
How are you doing?
Right now, he's got a hunt for gas.
Oh.
No, I don't have to hunt, Dick. They do shift changes, you know, and one place does it at 1 a.m., another place does it at midnight, so they're nearby each other, and the prices are not bad.
What time are you going to go to bed,
Eric? Yeah, as soon as I get home. So do your talking, you got about another 10 or 15 minutes before you get the repeater down.
Oh, okay. John, how was your day?
Good day today. Weather was good, everything went well, so I'm happy with the day.
Okay. Well, this time, I have everything prepared. I didn't want to do it during the weekend time. So, I wanted to have a break. And now that I'm going to get the guys to get the footage. So, this is what I'm going to do. I have some material to send you and to Royce. That would be.
Hi, did you have a chance to look at anything that I sent to Mr. Click?
I looked at those last two emails. Remember, we talked about it with the magnet where he was claiming the magnetic domain disappeared in a certain neutral zone and that stuff. Yeah, I saw them.
Yeah, that is kind of questionable. See, I'm not saying that he necessarily was creating a hoax. The guy didn't have a base. Roy had a beautiful analogy, and that would be the blind man and elephant. I've looked at this at Wikipedia. I've heard about it before. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, sure. I understand. It was, several blind people grabbing an elephant's tail, one had the nose, you know, back and forth, trying to describe an elephant. So, yeah.
Right. And that was a good. I don't know if you got the letter from Roy, the one that I have. I sent him two articles.